Hello and welcome to this podcast focusing on EGFR mutated metastatic NSCLC. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Drs. Balázs Halmos, Enriqueta Felipe, and Julia Rotel discuss the latest evidence in the management of EGFR mutated NSCLC with a focus on personalized treatment strategies based on factors such as molecular profile, disease burden, and patient fitness. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from Black Diamond Therapeutics. First, Dr. Roto takes us through the current treatment landscape for metastatic EGFR-positive NSCLC, focusing on three key trials that established first-line standard of care treatments, FLAURA, FLAURA2, and MARIPOSA.
So osimertinib has been was our strategy, EGFR TKI, from 2018 until around 2023 was really our only go-to first-line monotherapy option. That was based on the FLAURA study, which showed improved progression-free survival and improved overall survival compared to earlier generation EGFR TKIs. The story is more complicated. Late 2023, we saw data for the FLAURA2 study showing improvements in PFS with addition of chemotherapy to osimertinib in the frontline setting, as well as the MARIPOSA study showing also improvements in PFS and now OS with the amivantamab-lazertinib combination in the frontline setting. So I'm going to take us through the data for these various regimens, but to benchmark it, first-line osimertinib monotherapy, when it was compared to early generation TKIs, improved overall survival, it had better tolerability, and it had better CNS activity with better CNS progression-free survival, all reasons why this was rapidly adopted when it became available. But what now? We do know that in real life, once patients develop resistance to EGFR TKI therapy, survival is limited and the patient's prognosis changes drastically. We know median overall survival in the FLAURA study, so first-line osimertinib, was about 3 years. If you look in the real-world setting, once patients actually progress on their osimertinib therapy, median survival is as little as less than 1 year. I think that rings true in clinical practice if you're managing these patients. So what is our data and why? That's why we think about now combination therapy in the frontline setting. We know that we want to extend response to initial therapy. So FLAURA2, this was first-line osimertinib plus platinum doublet compared to osimertinib for classically mutated, newly diagnosed EGFR lung cancer. This is randomized against standard 4 cycles platinum pemetrexed, followed by pemetrexed maintenance along with the osimertinib throughout that entire course versus osimertinib alone. There was a little increase in the response rate, 76%, 83%, but marginal. I think you see a little greater depth of response. But the real improvements in outcomes came from durability of response. So you see improvements in progression-free survival from approximately 16 months to 25 months. And this is really why now we've been talking about using this regimen in the frontline setting, particularly in high-risk disease. We always want to know who really needs chemotherapy, who can get away with monotherapy alone. I think we all want our patients to get monotherapy if they could. It's well tolerated. It's easy. This is some of the subgroup analysis. So CNS mets, these patients do worse. Plasma EGFR detectability, positive ctDNA, EGFR L858R, TP53 co-mutation, all predict for worse PFS on monotherapy, all derive greater benefit from the generally greater benefit from addition of combination therapy, with exception of maybe TP53, where there were very small numbers. I will point out that some patients can do very, very well on monotherapy. You can look at plasma ctDNA undetectable, 30 months monotherapy, 33 months with the combination, not a big difference in outcomes. This is another, I think, important piece of data from the FLAURA2 study looking at CNS responses, and this is one exception to the comment I made that you don't see differences in response data with these upfront therapies. So here there was a higher rate of CNS response to therapy and more CRNS complete responses, things suggesting, again, the CNS is hard to treat. Adding platinum doublet, which is also CNS active, may help to overcome some of those challenges of the blood-brain barrier. Now, we don't actually have positive overall survival at this time from the FLAURA2 trial. This is the most recent update to the overall survival data, certainly trending in the direction of better outcomes with upfront combination, but not yet achieving maturity or statistical significance. What about side effects? Of course, if these regimens were all just as easy, we'd use them immediately. They cause greater efficacy. Why not use them? Of course, it comes at cost of toxicity. And we all know what platinum pemetrexed is like to treat a patient with. More toxicities upfront, particularly cytopenias, less toxicities during pemetrexed maintenance. That's exactly what was seen in the FLAURA2 study. I think of interest also is the duration of therapy. Was it really feasible to treat a patient with ongoing pemetrexed maintenance? The answer is yes, to a certain extent. So on average, patients received only 12 cycles of maintenance pemetrexed. That was about 8 months of pemetrexed versus approximately 22 months of osimertinib on the regimen. So patients did tend to drop off and then continue on TKI alone. Does that matter? The answer is maybe yes. So certainly patients who are on pemetrexed longer did seem to do better in terms of PFS than those patients who stopped pemetrexed after a shorter period of time. That, of course, is confounded by the fact that patients who did well stayed on therapy longer, but it did suggest that a very short course of pemetrexed might not be adequate. Resistance, I won't say much here except that the resistance profile was really the same between post-OC chemo and post-OC monotherapy, so not a lot of big difference in the nature of acquired genomic resistance that was observed. Right, our other option, this may be less familiar, is the MARIPOSA trial. This study looked at a different strategy to intensify frontline therapy. So it used lazertinib, which is a different third-generation EGFR TKI, combined with amivantamab, an EGFR-MET bispecific antibody, and looked at this compared to osimertinib. Again, same population, newly diagnosed classical EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer. And there was a third arm, that lazertinib arm, that was not part of the primary endpoint, but certainly useful to understand the contribution of the various regimen components, useful for us when looking at osimertinib versus lazertinib. Again, very similar response rates, 86 versus 85%. That's not where the story is in these combination therapies. But again, longer duration of response when you have something up front that's a little stronger intensity of therapy. Here's the PFS. There we go. So 16 months versus 23 months approximately. Now, also interestingly, this curve, we did include the lazertinib arm in addition to the osimertinib arm. Those really overlapped, and I consider them to have had very similar outcomes on this trial. And interestingly, the osimertinib arm had a very similar outcome to the monotherapy arms in the FLAURA trial, so very similar control arms across both studies. The PFS data is a little different in the MARIPOSA trial. So this is the intracranial progression-free survival. So a significant difference between the design of the FLAURA2 study and the MARIPOSA study is that all patients on the MARIPOSA trial had serial brain MRI imaging, regardless of baseline CNS status. That means that you can actually read out an intracranial PFS regardless of baseline status. See, the median is actually the same, 25 versus 22 months. There was some separation of the curves late as patients were followed out longer, and I believe this is going to continue to be followed with longer-term survival outcomes. So there were different sets of high-risk features looked at in the MARIPOSA study, but some overlapping. So CNS metastases, the ctDNA detectability, TP53 co-mutation were all highlighted in this particular trial. They also showed data for ctDNA clearance and presence of liver metastases. And as before, patients with high-risk features generally did worse than monotherapy, did better with combination therapy, and had a greater magnitude of benefit with combination therapy. So similar story, if you're high risk, you definitely probably need combination therapy. If you're low risk, there's a greater source of debate. What is the correct strategy? Right, overall survival, so this I think is important. This is a recent update from just a few months ago at ELCC. So this is now the mature overall survival data from the MARIPOSA study, which was positive, so statistically significant improvement in OS with the upfront combination. Median had not yet been reached, so we can't actually tell you what the actual median difference is, but it's predicted to be more than 1 year median overall survival advantage. Now, putting some caveats on this, there were differences in next-line therapy between the two trials. Amivantamab was not available as part of standard of care in the second-line setting, so patients on the study essentially did not get it in subsequent therapy, only about 1%, and therefore, certainly there's a question of crossover and its impact on survival outcomes. As we'll see the data in the MARIPOSA 2 trial, certainly was not causing dramatic survival improvements.
Dr. Roto then moves on to discuss the safety challenges posed by newer combination regimens, as well as strategies for improving their tolerability. She first discusses the SKIPPER trial, which evaluated a steroid-based prophylactic regimen for reducing the risk of infusion-related reactions with IV amivantamab, followed by the COCOON trial, which assessed the use of enhanced dermatologic management, and then the PALOMA 3 trial, which evaluated the use of subcutaneous amivantamab.
Safety, again, this I think why you would say, well, positive OS, let's adopt this right away. Certainly there is a more challenging safety profile to this combination, and I'll highlight there were significantly higher grades of cutaneous toxicity, MET-related toxicities like edema, and infusion reactions in about two-thirds of patients. The infusion reactions are almost all on dose one or dose two potentially, but they do occur. There have been a lot of efforts with the Mariposa regimen to try to define prophylactic strategies that may alleviate or reduce or mitigate some of those toxicities. I'm going to run through them here because if you are using this in clinical practice, you should be using these prophylactic regimens to use this as safely as possible or as effectively as possible. So the first one is for the infusion reactions. Patients can receive increased dexamethasone pre-medication for the 2 days prior to therapy. It's 8 dex BID for those 2 days and then dex the morning of. And that did, in a single-arm study, reduce risk of infections by about threefold, so can help reduce infusion reactions, which is a good thing. There's also been efforts to do a more aggressive dermatologic prophylactic regimen, trying to reduce dermatologic toxicities, piloting the outcome from that study. There were decreased cutaneous toxicities, still a lot of paronychia, which is hard for our patients, and we're thinking about balancing frontline regimens, but absolutely this is a regimen that should be used for prophylaxis if you're going to treat with these agents. This is the dermatologic prophylaxis regimen. I think it's familiar if you've ever given afatinib, and that patients should get a tetracycline antibiotic for the first 3 months, then they do a topical clindamycin to their scalp, they get a topical chlorhexidine to their fingernails for the first 3 months, and moisturizer is a good idea daily. There were also VTE seen in the first 4 months of therapy at higher rates than on the control arm of the study, so patients also get a VTE prophylaxis the first 4 months. So certainly a lot of things to think about if you're going to use this regimen. They're all essential to using it appropriately, in my opinion. All right, so can we do anything else to help with this? A topic that gets a lot of discussion is the upcoming, hopefully, availability of subcutaneous amivantamab. So we know that if you give this subcutaneously in a randomized trial compared to IV dosing, this substantially reduced the rate of infusion reactions, which is, again, very exciting. If you've ever managed an infusion reaction to this, it is not a good experience, down from 66% to 13%. So that, I think, is going to be a good step for our patients. Though it does not alleviate the cutaneous toxicities, which were at similar rates in both arms. And it reduces VTE a little bit as well. Now, tantalizingly, in the Paloma 3 study, the subcutaneous formulation did actually have better overall survival than IV as well, so that's an interesting trend. I'm not fully explained at this time, but again, hopeful as we think about ideally transitioning to subcutaneous formulation when we hope that becomes available. Lastly, time toxicity. So I just talked about side effects measurable in clinical trials, but what about the toxicity to our patients' real day-to-day life? What happens when you treat a patient with these regimens? What actually is their experience? The answer is, to give a combination regimen, you're asking your patients to have a lot more visits to clinic, about 19 visits in the first year for my patients if I do Flora-2, 30 visits in the first year for my patients if I do Mariposa. You're asking them to take on IV infusions, 4 to 6 hours on the initial infusions in Mariposa, 2 hours later, about 40 minutes total in Flora-2, and additionally, all those prophylactic regimens I just talked about. So for a patient, we're taking on a lot when we suggest an upfront combination regimen. That means we're really left weighing first-line treatment options. I truly believe there's no one-size-fits-all decision for this. There's no one answer that's appropriate for everyone. I think the first decision is going to be, when you see a patient, do they need monotherapy, or are they someone who should think about combination therapy? And that's a matter of both the disease features. Is the disease high risk, where you maybe want to push a little harder to encourage or recommend a combination regimen? Or are there low risk features, where maybe the net benefit's a little smaller? And then, of course, there's the patient preference. This is a big impact on quality of life. Some patients do not feel that fits their wishes when they have a diagnosis like this. So weighing what the patient wants in terms of how they view the downsides of combination therapy is also critical. If you do make the decision that a combination regimen is correct, I think there are two now upfront combination regimens available. So weighing them, they're very different in experience. They both add IV dosing. I would say the Flora-2 regimen offers an easier toxicity profile and a more familiar toxicity profile. I think it has very good data for CNS activity. The Mariposa regimen has now overall survival data and possible future subcutaneous dosing. So I think for a patient who's seeking very, very aggressive therapy, you're really left, I think, talking about all three options.
Next, Dr. Halmos discusses mechanisms of resistance to frontline EGFR therapy and potential second-line treatment options, including newer TKIs and antibody-drug conjugates. Of note, this excerpt was recorded before June 23, 2025, when the FDA granted accelerated approval to datopotamab deruxtecan for the treatment of adults with advanced EGFR-mutated NSCLC who have received prior EGFR-directed therapy and platinum-based chemotherapy.
You know, we have a hard time here because we want to use precision medicine. That's the first line. We learned it, 10 subsets EGFR across In the second-line setting, though, post-osimertinib, resistance can be very variable. It can be also very multiclonal, polyclonal, heterogeneous. So it's actually very hard to find, you know, the right, you know, treatment, you know, for the specific patient. Just too many round holes for the peg that we want to use. So what's the best sequence? You know, here there's a lot of sequencing discussions as to what was the first choice, Aciflora-2 or amylaser. Let's just think about, is it oligometastatic progression versus is it more systemic progression? Because you can get, you know, fairly good, you know, bang for the buck, you know, for an isolated, you know, progression event with radiation surgery and get more benefit from just continuing the treatment that you have on board. And yes, indeed, we can learn about precision medicine, acquired resistance mechanisms. We'll talk about them, both second, you know, site mutations of EGFR, as well as, for example, MET amplification, et cetera. And yes, indeed, we'll be able to make informed choices about the rest of the maybe more treatment-agnostic options as well. So very, very briefly, acquired resistance on target. You know, the most common here is C797S. That's super logical, as osimertinib covalently binds to the cysteine residue. If it changes, suddenly the binding is no longer as tight. But as we learned, dependent on, you know, whether, you know, that mutation is on the same, you know, allele or not of EGFR, adding a first-generation EGFR TKI could possibly help. But also maybe it's a fair consideration to look into now, you know, fourth generation of EGFR TKIs that is specifically developed to be able to overcome this most frequent, you know, second resistance mutation of EGFR. And there's multiple choices, and I'm not familiar myself with all of them. I'm familiar with one of them, BDTX1535. Maybe a black belt of EGFR TKIs in a way that's able to, in fact, in vitro overcome C797S mediated resistance. Now we're starting to build evidence from clinical trials as well that it does have a reasonable, promising activity for patients with a variety of mutations, including C797S. Now, we spoke about, you know, other mechanisms of resistance, and MET amplification is the most common bypass resistance mechanism, not the only one, but the most important to remember. 10 to 15% of the patients on osimertinib will develop this, and it turns out that this actually is a fairly actionable alteration. Combining an EGFR TKI with MET TKIs now has been tried in a large number of clinical trials, showing significant activity, but also a bit of added adverse events, of course, you know, with the addition of the MET TKI. And just this morning, you know, we actually learned from a very nice study, the SACHI study, which I think was the most practice-changing study presented today, that now in a randomized fashion, looking at combinations of EGFR MET versus chemotherapy, yes, indeed, there's benefit in terms of quite significant progression-free survival benefit, improved response rates. The study does have some caveats in terms of mixing first and third-generation TKIs. It also, you know, has a different threshold for MET amplification dependent on whether first or third-generation TKI was used. So there's a couple of nuances. That being said, I do believe it confirms that precision medicine is here to stay. So let's focus a little bit on ADCs, a different class, and there's been just a bonanza the last couple of years as to HER2, HER3, TROP2, and MET-targeting ADCs impacting patients with EGFR-mutated lung cancer, or this, you know, larger space in a way. So the first one to discuss is HER3-DXd. This is the one that's been kind of studied for the longest time, and it seems logical because HER3 is a critical component of EGFR cell surface signaling. And yes, indeed, from the HER3 and Lung01 study, it did appear that the drug has significant activity with a response rate of around 30%, and also seemed to have CNS activity and a reasonable adverse event profile. So it looked like, you know, something that in clinically we could use. It did not get approved by the FDA last June due to some manufacturing issue, so it's been even more important to wait now for the results for HER3-Lung02, a randomized study comparing doublet chemotherapy with patritumab in the post-osimertinib setting. The study actually looks positive on the first look. There's a hazard ratio of 0.77 in terms of PFS prolongation, and also some intracranial activity that was noted. So it looks like a good start against our best doublet chemotherapy. Not something, you know, more mediocre, such as second-line docetaxel. But this is where the Hertina trial kind of, you know, led to some hurt in the field, that the adverse event profile actually looks a little bit worse than I might have anticipated from previous reports. It does look somewhat more toxic than chemotherapy on a certain level. And, you know, there's no OS benefit. The OS curves overlap. Now, you know, if I was a clinician, is that a big setback? I mean, it still sounds like a valuable drug. Yeah, it's just as good as doublet chemotherapy, and we're very eagerly using doublet chemotherapy. But it does seem that the FDA will not be willing to look at this for FDA approval, and actually patritumab was voluntarily withdrawn. You know, it's its BLA application this week. A little bit of deflating result for the entire field this week. But let's focus a little bit on medicines that might be closer to approval, you know, for our practices. And number one here is Dato-DXd. There's been a lot of excitement about this anti-TROP2 ADC. And indeed, initially it seemed like it could be docetaxel for a larger pool of patients with metastatic lung cancer in the second-line setting. The results of the TROPION-Lung01 study, reasonable hazard ratio, you know, significant p-value for PFS. But what this study showed is an unexpected difference in between squamous and non-squamous lung cancer, to the point that there's harm, you know, in this particular study for patients with squamous cell lung cancer, basically obliterating the ability of this study to look at, you know, the maybe more important patient population, non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancer, in a statistically meaningful way. So it's not going to yield a Dato-DXd approval for the overarching, you know, group of patients. But it also highlighted very specific activity for actionable genomic alteration positive patients. Dato-DXd, you know, has some safety concerns, very particularly fairly high grade of mucositis, some pneumonitis, eye toxicity, and mostly paper toxicity when it comes to heme issues. Generally speaking, you know, seem to be better tolerated though than docetaxel. So it seemed like a drug actually we would like to have. Based on a higher response rate, better safety, and PFS improvement over docetaxel. And it seems like maybe it will become available for us to use for patients with EGFR mutated lung cancer, as the company now has taken a pooled analysis of taking patients from TROPION-Lung01 as well as another study, TROPION-Lung05, focusing on actionable genomic alteration positive patients. Now, of course, if you could have biomarkers that could, you know, identify patients of enriched benefit, might be nice. And this is where there's an effort now of a very unique biomarker called NMR-QCS, you know, that is basically focused on membrane versus cytoplasmic expression of TROP2. It turns out that maybe the cytoplasmic expression is more important, as the drug needs to be internalized, needs to be digital pathology, artificial intelligence combined together, so it would take a huge global effort to pull it off. But if it's very valuable, maybe we will. In this study, if they took biomarker positive versus negative patients, it made no difference in the cohort of patients treated with docetaxel, but separated patients very nicely as to enrich benefit of biomarker positive patients with Dato-DXd. There's other promising anti-TROP2 ADCs, so this is a field definitely we'll want to watch. Sacituzumab, tirumotecan. And this is a drug now that we just learned about today in great detail from the OptiTROP-Lung03 study, SAC-TMT versus docetaxel. And this seems to be more impressive than what we saw with TROPION-Lung01, much improved overall response rate, and slight improvement in terms of responses using TROP2 analysis by IHC. And indeed, a much improved progression-free survival, and in fact, an early overall survival, you know, benefit.
Dr. Philippe covers data from the Papillon trial, which informs treatment selection in patients with EGFR exon 20 insertions.
The Papillon trial in first line, comparing in these patients treatment-naive chemo plus AMI versus chemo, showed that progression-free survival was longer with chemo plus AMI when compared to chemotherapy alone, with a hazard ratio of 0.39. And this regimen, chemo plus AMI, is now approved in the first-line treatment for patients with EGFR exon 20 insertions. In the subgroup analysis, all subgroups benefited from the combination of chemo plus AMI when compared to chemo alone. Response rate was 75% for those patients treated with chemo plus AMI 47% for those patients treated with chemo alone. Also, there is a longer duration of response with a combination with AMI when compared to chemo. In the first presentation and publication in the New England, also PFS2 was longer with a chemo plus AMI, and it was data of overall survival, although was not mature, with a hazard ratio of 0.67 and not statistically significant at the time of analysis. When we discuss the safety profile with the patients, I'm going to focus in the combination of chemo plus AMI, grade 3 or higher. We can see paronychia in 7% of the cases, rash in 11% of the patients, and stomatitis in 1% of the patients, grade 3 or higher. We presented the ELCC last year, the time to treatment discontinuation, and it was also longer with chemo plus AMI when compared to chemotherapy alone, and also the sites of the first progression. And with AMI plus chemo, the brain was the first site of disease progression in 5% of the patients, 9% of the patients with chemotherapy alone. And also, the time to subsequent therapy was longer with chemo plus AMI when compared to chemotherapy alone. There was also a presentation about the circulating tumor DNA at baseline in the analysis, and approximately 80% of the patients have a positive circulating tumor DNA, and the clearance was higher for those patients treated with chemo plus AMI when compared to chemo alone.
Finally, Dr. Faleep discusses management strategies for patients with atypical EGFR mutations beyond exon 20 insertions.
Discuss the other atypical EGFR mutations, excluding patients with exon 20 insertion mutations. And according to the ESMO guidelines and also ASCO guidelines, for this group, atypical excluding exon 20 insertion mutations, afatinib and osimertinib may be considered. And afatinib is due to the fact that in the pivotal trials, they included, the studies included these mutations, the typical mutations. So we have data because when we compare with other trials, these mutations were not included. So these atypical EGFR mutations, excluding exon 20 insertions, were included in the LUNX-LUNG2, LUNX-LUNG3, and LUNX-LUNG6. And we know that overall, the response rate with afatinib in this group of mutations is 71%, with a PFS of 10.7 months and an overall survival of 19.4 months. And in this case, those patients with a G719X mutation had a response rate of 78%. Those patients with a L861Q mutation response rate of 56%. But there are data also in these atypical and common EGFR mutations with osimertinib. There is one study showing that osimertinib is associated with a response rate of 50%. And in this case, in presence of the L861K mutation, the response rate was 78%. And there is also a paper in the ESMO Open analyzing the role of osimertinib in atypical EGFR mutations. And overall, we have seen that for those patients with PAC mutations, the response rate with osimertinib is around 37.5%. So there is also one analysis of the combination of AMI plus LASER in patients with uncommon atypical EGFR mutations, treatment naive or post first or second generation TKI, and the response rate with this combination was 51%, and also the median PFS was really promising, 19.5 months. And again, it seems that there are differences according to the different mutation type. However, the numbers are rather small.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description. To earn credit for participating in this podcast, please follow the instructions on how to receive credit information in the episode description.